to this evening's guest lecture by Dr. Wayne Pagels, Apocalypse, How the Book of Revelation Haunts Contemporary Politics. My name is Dr. David Scheer. I'm the chair of the Religious Studies Department, the Lewis B. Singer Research Chair in Jewish History, and member of the Jewish Studies, History, and Religious Studies faculties. I've got lots of hats going here. But it's my honor and pleasure to, and thrilled to have Dr. Pagels here with us tonight. To introduce her, I'm going to introduce my colleague, Sam Boyd, who is our new hire. He's been here for maybe 1 year, and he's been an awesome hire. Amen. I'm really grateful that Sam Boyd is now on our faculty, and I know many of you here have probably can confirm what I am saying to you, that he is really excited to have him on our faculty. This event is sponsored by the Department of Religious Studies and the Conference on World Affairs. John Griffin, who's the director of the conference, sends his regrets he's not able to be doing what I'm doing by introducing Sam Boyd, but he is here in spirit. Without further ado, I turn the room over to Sam Boyd.
Thank you very much, David. Welcome. Today is Thursday, April 13th, 2017. It's 5:30 p.m., and this is Professor Elaine Pagels' talk, Apocalypse, How the Book of Revelation Haunts Contemporary Politics. Good stories need skillful storytellers. In the realm of biblical studies, such skill requires a careful balance. On the one hand is the popular and often political appeal for books on the Bible, a market that consists of a dizzying array of motivated speakers and readers, from critical seekers of its history to those seeking predetermined results affirming their religious perspectives, to those readers desiring information to show that the Bible is an antiquated mythology with little or no relevance to the modern world. On the other hand, is the academic book market, where scholars often revel in complexity with little or no attention to an audience beyond the narrow disciplinary boundaries that define the study of the Bible in ancient history. The challenges for the storyteller are great, and the skills require balancing the constraints and demands of the audience. The ability to maintain intelligibility, public trust, and write in a manner that readers of all backgrounds feel invested in the subject matter while at the same time fearlessly challenging its perceptions, and as J.C. Smith reminds us, taking seriously the job of the historian to explore complexity and avoid words of simplicity. Well, you get the idea. The task is Herculean. The risks are many, and the rewards, the well done, are innumerable. There's been no greater storyteller of early Christianity and early Christian traditions than Elaine Pagels. Professor Pagels is the Harrington Spear Payne Foundation Professor of Religion at Princeton. She received the Howard T. Behrman Award at Princeton for her contributions to the humanities. She's been the Harvard Genius Fellow, and she recently received the National Humanities Medal from President Obama. Professor Pagels has authored many articles and books, and she won the National Book Award for her 1979 publication titled The Gnostic Gospels. It was this book that, as a senior in high school, opened up to me the reality of the Bible as I knew it was not an historically self-evident and inevitable document. Growing up as I did in the South, for both non-religious and religious persons, the Bible is a constant in political, social, and of course religious discussions. It is often treated as the ultimate cultural constant, the touchstone that dominates public discourse, and the book that always was, is, and ever will be. Elaine's The Gnostic Gospels made intelligible to me for the first time the historical processes and factors involved in the making of early Christianity. It encouraged in me the dual disciplines of reading historical sources and narratives, both critically and empathetically, and it made inviting the study of the New Testament and its development and other perspectives in early Christianity. I then encountered her beyond belief after college and early in my graduate studies, the Gnostic Paul. In the latter, I was amazed at the manner in which she uncovers the modes of engagement that Valentinians and other Gnostic sects read Paul constructively. Again, challenging my perspective that the second century reception of Paul and Irenaeus was a historical given and inevitable endpoint. To accomplish these feats, while at the same time giving a fair, critical, and empathetic treatment to the sources in the New Testament, and thinkers such as Irenaeus and others who became the bedrock of Orthodox Christianity, to do all that, is testimony to Professor Pagels' ability as a as is the fact that her works have inspired countless people, such as me, to explore ancient history. Though my specialty is the Hebrew Bible and the ancient Near East, it's because of her books and the way that she opened up history as a conversation for me that I challenge my students when they read a document, whether the Bible, the Gilgamesh, or an Assyrian narrative description, to ask, who wrote this and why? How is it that this survived, and were there other accounts that could have been written and were lost? For these and innumerable other reasons, many of us owe Professor Pagels an incredible debt of gratitude. More recently, in 2012, Professor Pagels published Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. Of this volume, Daniel Boyard, an esteemed professor at the University of California, Berkeley, stated, quote, "Let me just say that it is the best story account of the formation of Orthodox Christianity that I have ever come across." In print. Wow. In this book, Pagels masterfully weaves what is called the agonistic or competitive histories of early Christianities with the ways in which the Book of Revelation and the New Testament operated in such ways. The result is a readable volume that explores the historical environment of John of Patmos and how diverse historical characters employed his literary creation in a highly charged political environment. In a sense, then, Pagels offers us a microcosm, namely an exploration of religious identity in the afterlives of the Book of Revelation specifically, which presents modern, modern religious and secular people as a perennial issue, namely the manner in which the Bible generally, for better or for worse, is shaped and also shapes modern political discourse and policy. This subject matter of the Book of Revelation and politics is the basis for her talk tonight, titled Apocalypse, How the Book of Revelation Haunts Contemporary Politics. Please join me in welcoming Professor Pagels to Boulder.
Thank you so much. Is this working? Great. And I really deeply appreciate the welcome that Professor David Shear and Professor St. Boyd and others in the department and the university have offered. The Book of Revelation, I have to tell you, is the strangest book in the Bible. It's been the most controversial one. It doesn't have ethics in it. It doesn't have stories. What it has are visions, dreams, and nightmares. Now, many rational people despise this book, as you know. And I avoided it too, actually, until George Bush actually initiated the war in Iraq, and he was using these visions to speak about the war. And I began to think, how is it that somebody even, 2001 or 2003 as it was then, and now, how is it that people today are still reading their present conflicts out of a book that's written 2,000 years ago? And a book that has always been famous for more obscurity than clarity. Now, just in case you haven't read it lately, I thought I'd give you a quick sort of Cliff Notes version of what is in this remarkable book of prophecies. It starts as with that, some images from art to show the enormous cultural impact this book has had for thousands of years. So the author opens, as he says he was on an island off the coast of what's today Turkey, the island called Patmos, and he said he was in the spirit, which means in a kind of trance, on one Sunday morning, and he heard a loud voice behind him. He turned around and he said he saw a divine being speaking to him. And John assumed that the divine being was Jesus of Nazareth, who had died 60 years earlier, but was now, John believed, speaking to him from a heavenly voice and saying, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen soon. This is another image of John receiving the message by a contemporary artist. John says that he then looked up in the sky and he saw a door open and a voice said, come up here. And somehow he said he was able to go up into heaven. He wasn't sure whether physically or not, but he went up somehow. And he was able to see what the prophet Ezekiel had seen hundreds of years earlier. He said he saw the divine throne of God surrounded by flashing light jewels and rainbows and the glory of God. And he said, as he was awed and overwhelmed by the vision of the divine throne, he then saw four horsemen coming out from below the abyss below the earth. The first one, on a white horse, had a sword and was given permission by the divine being to slaughter a third of the inhabitants of the earth. The second one came out and also had a sword so that people would slaughter one another. This one, I believe, is the third, and he comes bringing famine and death all over the world. And the fourth one comes forth from the lower abyss and brings forth disaster, suffering, earthquakes, and natural catastrophe. This is a vision of the future that John sees first. He says that after that, he saw other signs up in heaven. He saw omens in the sky. And one of them was a woman clothed with the sun. She's brilliantly dressed in the sun, and she's enormously pregnant, writhing in childbirth, about to give birth to the Messiah. But stalking her, there is a great red dragon. He doesn't look too red in this particular version of William Blake's, but he gets, in another one, you'll see another version. The dragon is stalking the woman as she's about to give birth in order to devour the child the moment that it's born. John says, as he watched the child was born, the dragon sort of lunged for the child, but the child was taken up into heaven, and the woman was given wings to fly off and escape. At that, the dragon was furious and went up into heaven, storming heaven. The dragon took his angels and went up into heaven. Now, how the dragon got angels isn't said, but the dragon did have angels, apparently. He was both a dragon and a human, and he went up to start a war with Michael, the archangel in heaven, with his angels. So the angels are battling, the good angels against these evil angels, led by the dragon. And you know the story, the dragon is thrown down. Sometimes you see him in a dragon form, and sometimes you see him in human form, thrown out of heaven as a supernatural enemy. And when he falls down from heaven, he was furious, and he decides that he lost his prey. He lost the Messiah. For John, that would have been Jesus of Nazareth, who had been taken up into heaven. And he lost the mother of the Messiah, who's probably seen as Israel. Christians later saw her as Mary. And so he decides to make war on all of the woman's children on earth. At that point, the dragon calls forth two enormous beasts as his allies. Now, this is a version, William Blake's version, of the two beasts that were, according to the book of Genesis, that were created at the beginning of time. In Jewish legend, they are a male and female pair, actually. The female is the oceanic one, and Behemoth is the male monster brought forth, according to Genesis, created by the Lord himself. But the dragon has brought forth these as his allies to fight and create evil on the earth. And the first of these dragons comes from the sea, and as John sees the dragon come from the ocean, it has seven heads and crowns on all of its heads, and it comes to dominate the entire world and force the world into submission to the evil power. The second dragon is here, a great red dragon, and also comes to dominate the world. And this one, John says, he says, this dragon has a human number. Let the reader understand. So he kind of hints that you're supposed to get the identity of this second dragon. Perhaps you know who it is, but we'll go into that. At that point, John says, there were seven angels in heaven, each one with an enormous golden bowl. And each one held a huge bowl full of the wrath of God. And a trumpet would sound, and the first angel pours the wrath of God on earth. Terrible things happen. Earthquakes, catastrophes, and suffering of all kinds. The second angel pours the bowl of God's wrath on the earth, and more disasters occur, wars and catastrophes. And the third angel, and the fourth, and the fifth, and the sixth angel pours the bowl of God's wrath right over the Tigris-Euphrates River, over Israel's ancient enemy, which is Babylon. And then as the seventh bowl of wrath pours down on that place, John said he heard horrendous explosions and brilliant flashes of light, and people on earth dying cursing God. After that, John says he saw Israel's ancient enemy Babylon, there she is, in the form that the prophet Isaiah had seen Babylon as a great whore, riding on the seven-headed beast, the seven-headed red monster, and she doesn't look too bad here, but actually she is a violent and horrendous creature who's drinking from a golden cup. And what she drinks is the blood of innocent people. There's another picture of the whore of Babylon. This is a contemporary one in acrylic and glitter. Toward the end of the story, John says he saw on Mount Zion, he saw the Messiah, God's Messiah coming with the whole army of angels. And he's coming to destroy the evil powers that have taken over the world. And he comes to battle and takes the serpent and chains him and puts him into a pit for 1,000 years. Then the evildoers are punished. This is a folk version of them. The Lord's representative, the Messiah, starts to judge the world. The final judgment has come. The good and the evil are going to receive their due, and the sea gives up its dead, the earth gives up its dead, they all come back to life, and they stand before the great white throne to be judged until the evil are thrown into a pit of fire that burns forever, and the righteous are taken into the heavenly Jerusalem, which descends to earth. So, you might think, so who is John and what was he thinking? This is a very hard book to understand. It's famous, right? But it does help to know that this is wartime literature. This is written by a Jewish prophet. He says his name is John. And he has probably escaped from his home city, Judea, in Jerusalem. And if you've been to Jerusalem, you know this is the way Jerusalem looked in the first century when John was there, probably around the year 90. A quarter of the entire city was the great temple with its complex of buildings. It was the temple treasury. It was the center of the whole holy city, a glorious and beautiful building. But when Jewish revolutionaries decided to fight against Rome, dominating the Roman Empire, dominating their land, as I mentioned yesterday, it's sort of like the American Revolution, in which the revolutionaries are fighting against the British Empire dominating this country. They decided to fight in the name of God and our common liberty. They fought in the name of God, a holy war against the Romans. And the Romans realized that the Jewish armies were no match for them at all. 60,000 Roman troops marched into Jerusalem, and for 4 years they besieged and starved the city. They killed and slaughtered people, stole everything they could. And finally, after the last battle, which took place in the temple itself, the Romans took the center of the city, that the great temple, and burned it down after desecrating the Holy of Holies with a sacrifice to the god Zeus, or Jupiter, the god of Rome. And then their troops, headed by Titus, who was then the commander, later became an emperor, took the stones from the temple, which are huge. I mean, there's probably as big as the screen, each of those enormous stones that built the great temple at the center of the city, and threw them down into a pile of rubble. And if you've been to Jerusalem, you've seen it, because you see only the wall that remains. Part of the Wailing Wall, as it's called, where people mourn for the destruction of Jerusalem. And an enormous pile of rubble from the temple is still there. Now, John of Patmos was probably a refugee from this war. We think he lived in Jerusalem, and like other Jews, he would have been horrified by what happened to the Holy City, what happened to his people. It's the most horrendous tragedy, or one of them, in the history of the Jewish people. But at the same time, John was probably also excited, because he was one of the people who actually followed Jesus of Nazareth and thought that Jesus of Nazareth was Israel's Messiah. Even though Jesus, as you know, had been crucified and arrested and killed by the Romans probably about 60 years before. And you could say, how could he possibly believe that Jesus was still the one God had chosen to rule the world after this happened? John probably would have said, well, Jesus, when he was alive, and 30 years before the war, had prophesied that these terrible things would happen. These are unthinkable things. But apparently John believed that Jesus had said they would happen, the unthinkable would happen, the city of Jerusalem would be destroyed and overcome by enemy armies, and the temple would be destroyed. I was thinking about this when I lived in New York, and I thought, if before the World Trade Towers were destroyed, if somebody had said in 1970 that the World Trade Towers would be destroyed by fire from heaven in minutes, you would think he would have to be crazy. But if then it happened 30 years later, you might think, if you thought the way John of Patmos did, that that person was a prophet. So when Jesus apparently, he thought, had prophesied that these things would happen, then they happened. John, like other followers of Jesus, was, besides being horrified, excited, because he said, Jesus said these things would come, they would happen within a generation, and right after that, the Son of Man would come from heaven, the end of the time would come, and God's kingdom would be established. So it was at that point that followers of Jesus went out and began to write the Gospels of the New Testament, saying, God's kingdom is coming soon. We know it, because Jesus prophesied this, what happened, but now, and now, he said, the other things are going to happen as well. So John of Patmos apparently left Judea at that point and went to Asia Minor, waiting for Jesus to come back and preaching. He waited 10 years and 20 years and then probably 30 years. Now, Jesus had said that these things would happen within a generation, and a generation had passed between his death and the time that this happened. But John waited another 30 years. And what had happened? He went to Asia Minor, to the great province, which is now part of Turkey. And if he walked into the city of Ephesus, the great city, he would have seen a statue about 20 feet high. This is the height of a human being. This is what's left of the statue. He would have seen the reigning emperor Domitian, 20 feet high, standing at the gates of, standing at the road that leads into Ephesus. So what John would have seen, that the kingdom of God, the kingdom that had come with power, was not God's kingdom. It was Rome's. Rome was still dominating the world. And if he had walked to the city of Aphrodisias, which isn't very far from there, and we know he traveled throughout that whole region, he would have seen a style of architecture that was initiated by the Emperor Augustus in Rome. And what it shows is, it's called the temple, it's called the Sebastion, that means the temple of the holy ones. And the Sebastion is a temple to the gods and to the emperors, who are their agents, of course. So if you walked up to the temple of Aphrodisias, which is on a high hill, you would have seen a panel like this. It's about that size, not quite that size. And this is a picture of Augustus himself, the emperor, ruling over land and sea. The reason he's naked is to show that he's among the gods now. He's not a human anymore. He's among the gods, and you see him ruling land and sea. And then Augustus had every nation that was conquered by the Romans on every other panel, 30 panels like this. If you walked around, you'd see another panel, and you would see Emperor Claudius, one of his successors, ruling shortly after Augustus. And Claudius part, you see the sculpture is damaged, but Claudius is raising the sword to slit the throat of a naked female slave who is raising her arm to ward off the blow, but she can't. And you see who she is. She is Britain. This is how Roman artists pictured the nations that they conquered, as naked female slaves subdued by the masculine military power of the Roman emperors. This is another panel which show Emperor Nero defeating Armenia, also forced to the ground, humiliated and ashamed. And you could walk around 30 panels like that and see all of the nations that Rome had conquered. And you could be very impressed, unless maybe you were drawn. And you think, one of my people, they're treating my people the same way. You would have seen on coins, coins that say Judea Capta, and Judea, also a province, as a naked female slave, subjugated by the power of Rome and Rome's gods. So I'm assuming that John must have been very troubled and angry to see the power of Rome on display as Augustus had wanted it to be. So what he did in the book of Revelation, just one piece of it that helps us in understanding, is he drew on the cultural resources of his own people, which were the prophets of Daniel, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, and drew upon their writings in order to claim that God was not going to allow the evildoers to rule the world forever. God was going to intervene. Israel's God was going to intervene at some point and destroy the evildoers. So he drew upon the ancient images of the ocean and the monsters of the ocean that the prophets used to depict the enemies of Israel. That is, Egypt, Israel's ancient enemy, is pictured in some of these prophetic writings as a monster. Babylon is pictured as a sea monster, as Leviathan or Behemoth, those ancient monsters that they said God had to fight at the beginning of time to create the world. John is now saying, well, today's Babylon, today's enemy, today's terrible empire that is evil is, of course, Rome. And God is going to come and destroy the Roman Empire the way that Babylon and Egypt deserve to be destroyed. So this is a kind of parable in prophetic language, perhaps because he was apparently a Jewish prophet. And to speak openly against Rome, about Rome as an evil, hostile, monstrous power, could put him in danger. We know that other followers of Jesus who made themselves prominent within the movement were executed as enemies against Rome the way Jesus had been, and therefore it could be dangerous. So what John does is write in code that Jews who were familiar with the Hebrew Bible and loved it the way he did would understand the code when he writes about the monsters Leviathan and how God is finally going to come and destroy them when the Messiah comes and he's going to reign over them. Now this is the story he tells. And what struck me is to ask the question, how do people keep using the book that's 2,000 years old? Because John had specific targets in mind when he wrote the book of Revelation. For example, when he talks about the beast whose number is 666, any ideas about this? He's using a language that some learned Jews used called Gematria, which has an equivalence between a letter and a number. So your name, you would take the letter and you would see what the number is of the first letter and the second letter, the third letter, the fourth letter. You could multiply, you could divide, you could do it many different ways. You could play out number speculation. But the number of the beast, the monster, that has the seven heads, first of all, the beast with seven heads is probably a clear image for Jews of the dynasties of the Augustan emperors, from Augustus to his own time, to the time of Domitian. If you count a certain way, there are seven of them, from Augustus at the beginning of the first century to Domitian at the end. And John particularly hated Domitian, the one who was reigning at the time he was writing this book, because Domitian's father was the commander who had gone into Jerusalem with 60,000 troops and destroyed the city. His father and his brother Titus was the emperor after that who finally ordered the destruction of the temple. So perhaps the number 666, many scholars think it is the imperial name of Emperor Domitian. And other people think, well, if you play it another way with the letters and the numbers, you could get the number, the name of Nero, the imperial name of Nero, who was hated even by Romans as the worst of all possible emperors, and therefore one who could epitomize the evil that John saw as Rome. So that seven-headed beast and the number is about, has a very specific reference. John also talks about a great mountain he sees. The mountain suddenly explodes and it pollutes the sea for days, and it pollutes the sky and all the fish die in the ocean. He has a very specific event in mind, which is the explosion of Mount Vesuvius, occurred in the year 79 of the first century, probably about 10 years before he wrote. And other Jewish prophets in the first century thought that the explosion of Mount Vesuvius, which they say could be seen all the way to Rome, and darkened the sky for days, and terrible, terrible catastrophe, was seen as a sign that the end times were coming. So John has very specific targets in mind. He also talks about the whore of Babylon and how she sits on a hill with seven rivers and seven hills. She sits on seven hills. Well, that's not hard to figure out, right? Because if he looked on the coins, he would see the goddess Roma sitting on seven hills. Any of the coins like that, and you can see them from the first century. Anyone with knowledge of the Hebrew scriptures and seeing the Roman coins would instantly know that the goddess Roma is the whore of Babylon. So he has these specific targets in mind, but I was thinking, how do people read this for 2,000 years over and over, interpreting their own conflict in terms of this battle of good and evil? Well, I think it's because, as John Collins at Yale has said, he doesn't give you specific targets in mind. He writes in this kind of prophetic code. He writes in the form of open symbols, as John Collins puts them. And because he does, they're sort of like the kind of images that any child could have in a dream of a horrible, devouring female, of a beast, of a monster. And so those images, you can almost plug any conflict you have into those images, and they can work. And so I wanted to talk about how this plays out as an afterlife of the culture even now, because perhaps you've heard recent things. In the First Crusade, when the Catholic King of France preached the crusade against the Muslims who were holding Jerusalem, he preached the Book of Revelation, and he said, "We have got to go and save the holy city from the beasts, from the monsters, who are the Muslims. Fight the infidels. It's a battle of good against evil, and we have to win." In the 14th century, when the Black Death killed about 30% of the population of Europe, horrible plague that nobody could stop, the Duke of Berry's artist said, this is what was said would be happening at the beginning of the end time. This is the horseman of the apocalypse, the first one that comes and is given permission to kill 30% of the inhabitants of the earth. This is it. And these corpses marching through the city are evidence that the end of time is upon us now. When Martin Luther's revolution split Christians throughout Europe, Martin Luther said he didn't like the Book of Revelation. He said that in 1523. He said, it's all this judgment. There's no Christ in it. But by the time he figured out how he could use it against the Catholic Church, he found it very effective. He asked his friend, the artist Lucas Cranach, to make pictures for the Luther Bible. It's the only book with pictures in it. is the apocalypse. And that's in order so that you, the reader, will know, whether you read or not, exactly who the Whore of Babylon is. And here you see that she is the Pope of Rome in Luther's Bible. The first Catholic biographer of Martin Luther pictured him as the seven-headed beast. And so this is the opening of the biography of Martin Luther by his Catholic biographer. This is Queen Elizabeth I as the Whore of Babylon. The Protestant queen was hated by Catholics. Catholics saw her this way. Protestants pictured her as the woman clothed with the sun, giving birth to the Messiah. What I found most fascinating is that people on both sides of every conflict can use these images against each other, and did. This is Napoleon as the beloved son of the devil. And in the wars in this country, this is the Civil War, seen from the southern side, a political cartoon from Mississippi in which Lincoln is being strangled by the beast, which is the Union. And so you see the way that this is the end of time. The terrible battles of the Civil War are played out on the fields of the South. This is the North fighting against the beast that is secession. So you see the seven-headed beast has the names of all the southern commanders. So you see that Christians on the South and the North play this out on both sides. And of course, you know this famous battle hymn. Oh, let's go back. Do you have it? I mean, we don't need to play much of it, but you know the battle hymn of the Republic. It was written by Julia Ward Howe when she was with the Union armies, and she, somewhat like Lincoln, saw the terrible carnage of that war as evidence that this is the end of time, the punishment for America's sin of slavery. And the language comes straight out of the book of Revelation or out of the book of Jeremiah, which John of Patmos uses. And we'll just... Can you hear it? The computer is thinking about it. And if we can't hear the triumphal march, you know this song very well and how it was played as a war song. Also saw the culture of his time as Leviathan in terms of the book of Revelation. And during World War II, you recognize the artist?
Hi, it's Dr.
Seuss. Dr. Seuss. It's a political cartoon. And this the beast, of course, is Adolf Hitler, seen from this perspective. And on the other side, by the way, it was read by Joseph Goebbels, who was Hitler's propaganda minister. There's a book called The Holy Reich, which explains that the Dritte Reich, the third thousand years, is Adolf Hitler is bringing in the thousand-year reign of Christ by freeing the world from human pollution, which included what? Jews, gypsies, people who opposed Adolf Hitler, anyone, homosexuals, anyone that the Nazi regime did not like. Adolf Hitler was ringing in the thousand-year reign of Christ, and this propaganda was sold to Catholic and Lutheran Christians alike in Germany. There's also music I wish I could play for you. I don't think it's going to work. But it's music that was played on the other side. It's written in 1941 in a Nazi prison camp by a prisoner named Olivier Messiaen. Messiaen was a Catholic, French Catholic, and he said one day he was in the prison camp, it was freezing cold, it was 1941, the Allies were doing terribly and the Germans were doing well, it looked awful. And Messiaen said he saw a rainbow, and it reminded him of the book of Revelation, in which there's an angel appears with a rainbow over his head, and the angel has one foot on land and one on the sea, and the angel says, there shall be no more time. And so Messiaen wrote what he called the quartet for the end of time. For the instruments that they had in the prison camp, they were broken instruments, string instruments mostly, and the prisoners played the quartet for the end of time in the prison for the prisoners and the guards. You remember this operation called Shock and Awe? Yes, well, how does that relate? The book of Revelation, you remember, the sixth angel of the book of Revelation pours God's wrath over Babylon, and the explosions take place, right? Now, Babylon is Baghdad. So if you were clued in, and maybe some of you were, I wasn't, if you understood, you would understand that this, the American bombs over Baghdad, destroying Baghdad, are shock to unbelievers, but they are awe to those who understand that this is God's wrath, which is being delivered by our American bombers. In fact, I also learned recently that Donald Rumsfeld's office sent to George Bush every day on the intelligence briefings for the war in Iraq a photograph and a quote from the Bible. One of those that I saw was a photograph of the gates of Baghdad with American tank going in with guns at the ready. And the quote is from the prophet Isaiah, which is, let the righteous nation enter. So this is the way the war is being read at the time. I'm not going to talk about current events, because if you like, we could. It's certainly seen as a, but what concerns me here is the way that these images of good and evil are the way that we have been taught by our culture to interpret conflict. That you can't think of two sides with different interests. If you thought of two sides with different interests, we could negotiate, right? But if we are good and they are evil, or if we are evil and they are good, then the only thing you can do with evil people, you can't negotiate, you have to annihilate them. And so this paradigm of interpreting conflict, which I think has worked in past generations, I happen to think is particularly catastrophic at the present, when not only is it read by people in this country and Christians throughout the world, or can be read by many in that way, but it's also read, of course, on the other side. My colleague Bernard Heichel at Princeton has studied the religious convictions of the group called ISIS or ISIL, and he says it's not just a political gang, it's not just a gang of gangsters, ISIL. He said it's a religious movement. My colleague has no sympathy with it at all. But he studies it and he says they have exactly the same eschatology in reverse. They see it, as you know, everything just as it's read by some people in this country, flipped. And so conflict of that kind can be particularly horrendous. So this is what makes me wonder, can we afford to interpret conflict this way now? Or can we just recognize that this pattern may not work? That's an editorial comment, sorry. And I want to say one thing, that this picture of Revelation is not always about war. Sam, I need you for another piece of music. It's also, the book of Revelation can also be read as a promise of divine justice. Because John said when he saw the throne of God, he saw under the throne people who had been slaughtered for the sake of God, and they were alive again, but they were saying to God, how long, Lord, how long before you judge and avenge our blood on the people of the earth? And that has been read into many kinds of conflict. Both the Christians executed and tortured by the Romans, to the abolitionists who saw people killed for fighting slavery and saw the people, the enslaved people and the people who fought for them as crying out, how long is God going to allow his people to be killed before he transforms the world? So the book of Revelation is also seen as a book about divine justice.
This,
this is a piece of art that I saw in New York. It's done by an African-American artist in Washington, D.C., James Hampton, who calls himself a director of special projects for the third millennium. And he, in his garage, he created, it's about as big as this room, a throne for God and a throne for the Lamb of God in the new kingdom, you know, in the glorious Jerusalem, when God rules the world again and justice is restored. James Hampton has this. It's now in the Smithsonian Museum. It's quite a magnificent piece. In African-American tradition, as you may know, there's a great deal, there's a lot of preaching about the book of Revelation, about the glory of the book of Revelation when God finally brings divine justice. So this is a different vision, and this is a one of many spirituals. This is called John the Revelator. Maybe.
It will be here, I promise.
Another is walking in Jerusalem just like John, but there are many. There are many spirituals that speak about the glory.
My little letter writing.
We will be doing the note card. We will be handing out, is this working? Hello? We will be handing out note cards for the Q&A session here. Raise your hand and for a question for about three questions or so. So please raise your hand and to get things started while people are writing questions. Thank you so much for that talk. That was just phenomenal. I'm always struck about how Revelation is written by a marginalized person suffering trauma and war.
Yes.
And yet becomes sort of the narrative of the people who hold power. You mentioned Athanasius in your book, but I'm even thinking of modern politics, the Left Behind series, which so thoroughly engages the book of Revelation as though these are the oppressed, marginalized, and yet Christianity and politics has been so dominant. And so much the tool of the powerful. The elasticity of this is just phenomenal.
Well, it's very interesting. You know, this book was very controversial. It was the most controversial book in the New Testament. There are many people who thought it didn't belong there. It's very different from the other books, right? And some people loved the book. And I think the people who loved it were people who were Christians who had seen their friends, their neighbors, their fellow Christians tortured and executed by Romans in horrible ways that the Romans knew so well how to do. And so this book was loved by people who saw in it the promise that God would not endure that kind of injustice and that, you know, justice would prevail. But then, as you say, when this movement is no longer marginalized and persecuted and it becomes the dominant culture of the Roman Empire, this plays in a very different way. Yeah.
And maybe one more just sort of observation while the cards are coming up. Here they are. Great, thank you so much.
Do we have some time?
Yeah. So can you actually, first question, can you reflect a little bit more on how it did make it into the canon?
Well, yeah, actually it's very interesting. This one was a very tough one to get into the New Testament. This is one of the earliest comments we have about what books belong, because when Constantine became emperor, he wrote to the bishops and said, okay, now I want a copy of the scriptures. And the question is, well, which ones? What are we going to include? I mean, there was pretty much agreement about the Gospels of the New Testament. They were widely read. But the earliest historian, Bishop Eusebius, who was an advisor to Emperor Constantine, he said, well, there are recognized books, and then there are disputed books. And this is the only book that makes both lists. Well, these are the recognized books. And the Greek is, and the Book of Revelation, if it seems appropriate to you. And then there are the disputed books, which don't belong, and none of the books on this list are in the New Testament. And he says, well, the Book of Revelation, maybe, should be on that list. So you can see that, you know, by the middle of the 4th century, there was an intense debate. And actually, we have 5 canon lists. These are lists by different bishops, different groups of bishops. They were councils. They would sit down and discuss it, draw up a list of what belongs. And every single one, four out of five, leaves Revelation out and says, it's not on my list, don't read it. Including the Bishop of Jerusalem, the Councils of Asia Minor, Gregory of Nazianzus. If there's anything besides this, it is not among the genuine books. And this I like. He says, he leaves Revelation out and says, this is the least falsified canon of the divinely inspired scriptures. So there's a lot of debate about what belongs. Now, Athanasius of Alexandria is a bishop in the late 4th century at the time of Constantine, and he is trying to consolidate Christians all over the world. And he realized, you know, people say, well, this book doesn't belong because the prophecies weren't fulfilled. I mean, it's about Rome being destroyed, right? But then Rome became Christian, so the book, it doesn't work. But Athanasius said, well, you have to take it literally. He said, we'll say that the beast is heresy, and the whore of Babylon are all my enemies. And that way it works perfectly well. So he began to read it that way. And this book kind of slipped in. But as I said, it is the most disputed. And perhaps it still is.
One more question. It was really good. Do you know of anything about the use of the Book of Revelation in the climate change debate?
No, do you?
I asked a question. I had heard a rumor about 10, 15 years ago that a climate change scientist, perhaps from Boulder, was asked to speak at an Exxon stockholder meeting. And he thought he was delivering a gloom and doom message. And later, the person who had invited him came up and said, that was great. You've shown us that in climate change, the Book of Revelations, the prophecy will come true.
Well, actually, yes, now that you mention, I remember some television program people asked me about this, because the Book of Revelation does talk about earthquakes and natural catastrophes all over the world. And so there are people who have said, well, you see, this has happened here, this kind of earthquake, these are more dramatic climactic events than we've ever seen before in terms of transformation of the earth. That's evidence that these are the end of days that are prophesied in the Book of Revelation. Thank you. I
And I guess this became a justification for Exxon continuing what it had been done.
Oh, that's great, because then they're going to bring in the intel.
Yes.
It works.
Well, that is unfortunately all the time we have for this session. So wonderful. Let's give Professor Pillows a round of applause.